So, as most of you are aware, I have a son. He's almost 9 months old. And most mornings I get to wake him up. So it's just the way our scheduling falls. So I walk into the bedroom and I have a light on a dimmer and I flip the light on and I walk over and I turn off the sound machine. And then typically he's awake by this time. And I grab him, but I leave him in the crib and I just sit him up because he's got a sleep sack. And I say, okay, it's now time to unzip the sleep sack. And he used to fight me, but now he's getting the hang of it. And then we say, time to take our arms out. And we pull the arms out. And then I pick him up and we change the diaper. And I tell you, time to change your diaper. You know, and I walk him through. And as I walk through this step by step, he's starting to become more and more aware of the process. By just going through something again and again and again, he's becoming aware of something really simple. That for now, he has to let me change him. And eventually he'll develop the skills to change himself. We do a similar thing at mealtime. We take the food and I put it on the table and I say, here's your food, it's time to eat. And then I set his spoon on his high chair and I set him in the high chair. And he sees the spoon, he's seen the food, and he lets me put him in the high chair instead of fighting me. And we repeat the process. And in a lot of ways, we do that all throughout childhood. We do simple physical things to learn simple physical truths. And then we start to add other things. We teach them how to deal with their emotions, how to do simple processes, and we're building them up. And it's repetition of something simple that equips a child to grow into adulthood. And that's a lot of what these holidays are about. As the beginning, we have these simple holidays with prescribed processes. And it's not always obvious right out of the gate why we keep them, why we do them. Just like for my son, he doesn't understand why he has to lie still and not kick for an entire 45 seconds so I can change his diaper. So just as, and I'll quote the verses later, but just as the Apostle Paul reminds us, these commandments are a tutor to us. They train us up in an understanding of who Messiah is. And it's not always obvious, but by keeping the Lord's commandments, we grow spiritually. We mature, we grow closer to God, better equipped and able to understand His Word. So I just thought that was a little dive in analogy. So feel free to tune me out from here because I think that was pretty good. first question of the day, when was Sukkot established? So when they were in the desert, they received the commandment regarding Sukkot, explanation of when and how to do it. But in a similar note, they also received the commandment for Passover, whereas they had already kept Passover. But I will give you a clue. Passover and Sukkot were established at the same time. So was Yom Kippur. So was Yom Teruah. Yes. Bit of a trick question. Day three. We see God establishes the sun and the moon and the stars for times, for seasons. And that's when Sukkot was established. The commandment for Sukkot obviously came a little later. The instructions for Sukkot obviously came a little later. But I do think it's important when we explore the holidays to realize that these were plans from day one. There's an old rabbinic saying that Passover happened on the day it did, because that's the day Passover was. You know, we don't celebrate, that's very poorly phrased, sorry. We don't celebrate Passover on the day it happened, because that's the day it happened. We celebrate Passover on the day we celebrate it, because that's when Passover is. It's this nuance. God established the days at creation, and the events fell on those days, and those are the days we celebrate them. That may not have made a lot of sense, and that's okay. First thing I want to do is I just want to look at the commandments themselves. I think it's really easy to get caught up in all the holidays and not just look at the simple commandments. So rather than have you turn, I just went ahead and printed out some of the simple parts. I'm going to warn you, there's another question after this. So I'll even tell you the question now. The question is, what are the commandments regarding Passover? The question, or Sukkot. What are the commandments regarding Sukkot? There's eight of them. There's 6 we can keep and 2 we cannot. Those are all the clues you're getting, though. Leviticus 23, verses 34 through 35 say, on the 15th day of the 7th month is the Feast of Booths. Chag Sukkot. For 7 days to the Lord, on the first day in a holy convocation, you shall do no laborious work. And then in verse 36 it says, for 7 days you shall present an offering. And then through the next verses it kind of works out what the offerings are. Then in verse 40, there's a commandment that's a little more applicable for us, where it says, take for yourself the fruit of beautiful trees, palm branches, leafy boughs, and willows of the brook, and rejoice. And then in verse 42, it says, you shall live in booths for 7 days. So that's kind of our first round of commandments. As a side note, the fruit of beautiful trees traditionally is regarded as the etrog or the citron. And the word itself, beautiful, is hadar, which could mean, you know, glorious, ornamental, majestic, or high or swollen. So there's a little bit of room to interpret what exactly that means, but traditionally, it's the etrog. I personally have never managed to get an etrog, and I typically forget until, like, the day of Sukkot, and I just get apples, because I figure apples are what's in season at the time. The apple trees are swollen. It's kind of a seasonal and a native variety, so who knows? Hopefully I'm doing okay. Deuteronomy 16 talks a little bit more about Sukkot. In verses 13 and 14, it just says, you shall celebrate the Feast of Booths 7 days. You shall rejoice. And then in verses 16 and 17, it says, three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord, and every man shall give as he is able. So that's kind of the dry, just commandment right there. So we see 8 different points. I'm just curious, how many jumped out at you guys? What do we have in terms of basic ones? First one's the obvious one, build a booth. What else did we get? Just holler them out. Rejoice, that's a big one. 7 days. Yeah, shall keep it beginning the seventh day of, or the seventh month, the 15th day, for 7 days. Okay. Yeah. Show up, and then they've got the that pilgrimage component too. No laborious work, so we've got a Shabbat. I stopped paying attention to how many fingers I had. What else? They're getting sent out to collect branches. Here's my list. Number one, beginning the seventh month, the 15th day, keep Sukkot for 7 days. Number two, a holy convocation. That's something that always jumps out at me when God gives his commandments, because it reminds me that I'm not really good enough by my own. You know, I can't keep a holy convocation by myself, because it means a gathering, a kahal, a holy. You translate it nowadays as church, you know. So I've got the holy convocation, no laborious work. We've got the sacrifices. We have the collecting of branches, the living in booths. I made those one. They could have been two. We have the pilgrimage. And then the two that until this year never jumped out at me for some odd reason, but we see them both in Deuteronomy there. Rejoice. That's a significant component, actually. And the other one is to give as able. I had actually been reading, and somebody made the comment about this season, this holiday season, that when we gather together on Yom Teruah, it's a period of repentance, a period of calling out the things and the areas in our life that we need to work on. And then we transition to Yom Kippur, which is a time of redemption. But once we've made it through that, we come to Sukkot, which is the time of rejoicing. And it's interesting because it's tied so closely to the harvest that it occurred to me for the first time this year that, whereas for most of us, after Yom Kippur, we all run to a restaurant and eat. The next day, we kind of take it easy because we're tired, and then we just wait for Sukkot to appear. For a lot of people, they'd be rushing out to harvest. And it's a really intense time of, I think there had to be a lot of preparation. And it may be just me, but I feel like I just kind of stumble through the holiday seasons every year. I'm like, oh, holiday season. And then you're restudying, you're relearning, whereas the amount of structure that they had in their lives before is it's really impressive to me. So those are kind of the basic commandments. The next thing I kind of looked at as I was exploring the topic of Sukkot was kind of the historical application. And I found two very interesting tidbits over in Ezra and Nehemiah. In Ezra 3:1, it talks about the people post-Babylonian exile. They're in the process of rebuilding Jerusalem, rebuilding the temple. And it says that, I'm reading verses 1 through 6, roughly. It says, the people from the cities gathered as one in Jerusalem. And this was immediately after the exile. And they say they built the altar to offer sacrifices. And they were terrified because of the peoples of the lands. And they celebrated the Feast of Booths as it is written. But the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not yet been laid. It really jumped out at me about the, they celebrated the Feast of Booths, which is a very public holiday. You know, you can do Passover in your house and you can kind of be sneaky about it. You know, unless somebody's curious why you're buying so much horseradish, you know, it's not going to jump out at anybody. But the Feast of Booths is very public. My backyard is about the size of this row of pews here, and my sukkah takes up a little more than half of it. I have a neighbor on either side who could probably reach over the fence and touch my sukkah. You know, so the first time I built it, it was strange because it's so obviously there. And I remember just having that bit of, what will the neighbors think? Well, I have to explain this to somebody. You know, kind of just that whole set of concerns that comes with publicly living out your faith. And that's why this Ezra is so interesting to me, that talk about painting a target on your back by making it obvious who you were. This is very interesting. And the other appearance is Nehemiah in chapter 8. And it's really hard to pin down the timeline between Ezra and Nehemiah, but my understanding is this would have been a sukkah or a sukkot a little bit afterwards. In verse 14 it says, they found written in the law how the Lord had commanded through Moses that the sons of Israel should live in booths during the feast of the seventh month. It says that they went out into the hills and brought olive branches, oil tree branches, myrtle branches, palm branches, and branches of leafy trees to make booths. And the people went out and made booths for themselves. And the entire assembly made booths and lived in them. And the sons of Israel had not done so since the days of Joshua, son of Nun. And there was a great rejoicing. And he read from the law every day and celebrated the feast 7 days. And the eighth was a solemn assembly. So obviously a couple things jumped out at me about this one. First, you have the collection of tree branches. It's a little different than the command, which makes me feel a little better about the fact that there's no local sources of palm for me to build my booth out of. The second one is that the entire assembly did it. Everybody there built booths and lived in them. And it says that the sons of Israel had not done so since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun. And that takes a little bit of, I guess, interpreting. It's not that the command hadn't been kept, but it's the first time since Joshua settled in the Promised Land that all of Israel kept the Feast of Sukkot. And that's just really interesting to me because I think it's, at least for me, it's easy to feel like I'm, you know, I have all of the Testament and Scripture, and you think that like they were doing so well, and then you look at your own life and you're like, yikes! But to realize that it's always been a process, and there's probably probably only in the future that things will truly be kept perfectly. It's actually really interesting to me. If you think about it. If you think about it, you've got from Exodus to Joshua, they're keeping Sukkot. And then you've got the Babylonian exile, and the people are, they're separated from their land, they're separated from each other, they're separated from their teachers. But they're still keeping Sukkot. Sukkot is still there. And they've got the rebuilding. Sukkot is still there. And it goes all the way to the time of Yeshua when you've got the Roman occupation, and they're still keeping Sukkot. You've got the destruction of the temple. You've got the Roman exile we're in right now. They're still keeping Sukkot. You have the crazy anti-Semitism that was in Spain during the Great Expulsion. They kept Sukkot. Germany, Sukkot was still there. And now here in America, Sukkot is still there. To me, it's just so, the richness, I guess, of participating in a commandment, participating in a holiday that has a timelessness to it, that was established in creation and will be kept through the end of time. Just, there's a strength there, and it's really neat plugging into that, because I think it's so easy to have an ambiguous faith, to wake up and say, I've got some beliefs, I've got some passion, I'm a spiritual person, and just call it a day. But plugging into something with such substance is really cool to me. And when we look at over in Deuteronomy 16, verse 14, it's talking about the commandment itself. It's talking about who's, you know, involved in keeping the commandment, who's involved in living in booths. And it's you, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite, the stranger, the orphan, and the widow. It's a pretty extensive list. There's not really a lot of people that are left off of that. And I think that's another cool one, because when you look at Passover, you know, kind of on the other end, it's a little more restricted. You're not supposed to be inviting everybody in the world to keep the Passover meal. The Passover meal is for God's people. Sukkot's kind of for everybody. In fact, if you read, start getting into the rabbinic sources, Sukkot's kind of like the evangelistic holiday. It's the one where you're reaching out to people. It's probably the closest I think most Jews come to evangelism would be just considering having a neighbor over in their sukkah. So it's a cool one. Now there's two other tidbits, I guess, with Sukkot that need discussed if we're really going to explore some of the cool things about it. And the first tradition was that of water drawing. So there's the water drawing ceremony. And every morning during Sukkot, the priests would walk down to the pool of Siloam. This was near Jerusalem. And they'd fill up this large flask of water. And they would carry the water back to the city. And this whole process is just kind of people with instruments, you know, the tambourine, which Tim forgot to put out for me. You know, people be shaken. There's, you know, trumpets. There's dancers. It was a great spectacle with much rejoicing. And they would walk down and they'd get the water. And then they would come up through the water gate. And the water gate had that name specifically because that was the gate the water was carried through. And they would come up to the altar and they would dump the water on the altar during part of the drink offering, which Grant had mentioned during his last teaching. And this process was traditionally connected to a verse over in Isaiah of the prophecy that says, with joy you shall draw water out of the wells of salvation. So there was this kind of deep hope attached to this process of carrying the water and dumping it on the altar. The other tradition was the lighting ceremony. Every night, kind of from sundown all the way through sunup, when they would go do the water drawing ceremony, they had these huge lamps set up. I had originally thought they were menorahs, but I guess they were just four large lamps. They were so big that they literally took gallons of oil, and the wicks were made out of braided fabric from old the old clothing of the priests. And it said that they were so bright that every courtyard in Jerusalem was lit from the light of these lamps. And the lamps themselves were set up in the woman's court. So it's inside the temple. It's not, you know, all the way in, but it's right there at the edge of the temple court. And that's an important location. So we're going to file that away. So just to make sure we caught it, what were the two big traditions that were associated with Sukkot in the Second Temple period? It was the water drawing. The water drawing and the lighting ceremony. I'm going to keep trying to just get a little bit. It's all right. Feel like I would just want, maybe I'll try for an amen at some point, just kind of loosen you all up. So I just want to keep those both in our minds, because in a second we're going to see why there's a deep significance attached to both of those for us. But before I do that, there's two prophecies that really resonate in my mind regarding, again, Sukkot. You've got over in Zechariah chapter 14. We're talking about the millennial, the time to come. And verse 9, it's kind of setting the stage. And it says, "The Lord will be king over all of the earth. And in that day, the Lord will be Echad, in his name, Echad." And Echad, we commonly translate it as one, but it means so much more than one. It means unified and complete and whole. And there's a lot of discussion about what it means when it says that God will be Echad and his name will be Echad, because it begs the question, is it not now? A lot of depth there. But I'm skipping over all of that for the next verse. Verse 16, it says, "It will come about that any who are left of all the nations," and that word nations is goyim, which we translate as Gentiles. "So it will come again that if there are any left of all the nations that went against Jerusalem, they will go up from year to year to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, to celebrate the Feast of Booths." That's heavy, I think, for the simple reason that a fair share of people assume that God's commandments, God's holy days, are a thing of the past, that they were some sort of primitive ritual kept by some people that we kind of took their religion from and moved on. But the reality is that we see in this prophecy here that in the time to come, they will be celebrating the Feast of Booths. And the Feast of Booths, as you recall, is a pilgrimage holiday. It was a day when all of God's people came. All of the men were expected to come to Jerusalem. And now it's saying that from all the nations, people will be coming to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Booths. The second of the prophecies that I like is over in Ezekiel 45. And it says, "During the 7 days of the feast, the prince shall provide as a burnt offering to the Lord 7 bulls and 7 rams without blemish on every day of the 7 days, and a male goat daily for a sin offering. He shall provide as a grain offering an ephah with a bull, an ephah with a ram, and a hin of oil with an ephah. In the 7th month, on the 15th day of the month, at the feast, he shall provide like this: 7 days for the sin offering, the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the oil." And again, there's significance here because in my reading, my understanding of it, this prince is Yeshua. And this is the keeping of Sukkot, even the sacrifices in the millennial kingdom. So it kind of, there's a need for a little bit of a paradigm shift. Our next stop is going to be in John 7. I'm going to give you a chance to turn to that, and I'm going to wet my throat. All right, so we are at John 7. Take a peek at verse 2. And then tell me at what time this exchange is occurring. So, John 7 is happening right now, around 2,000 years ago. So the account in John 7 is one that's happening this season. It says the Feast of Booths was near. And as you guys all know, the Feast of Booths is near for us as well, because it's starting, I believe, tomorrow night. So that's kind of our context for what's going on in John 7. And I believe that this scene remains set all the way through towards the end of John 8. So when we look at verse 8, we see that his brothers have come to him, and they're kind of trying to get him to come to the Feast of Booths with them. And he says, "Go up to the feast, by yourselves. I do not go up to this feast because my time has not yet fully come. But then when we read down to verse 10, it says, when his brothers had gone up to the feast, he himself also went up, not publicly, but as if in secret. And again, it's kind of paradoxical. You know, it's just leaves us wondering. He told them, I'm not coming, and then he goes up there. And then when we get down to verse 14, we see him talking about, I'm not going to go, my time has not yet come. Then he goes up in secret, and now he's publicly teaching in the temple. So, a confusing shift in policies. But it says in verse 14, when it was now the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began to teach. So, let's call it Wednesday. We don't know exactly. But, and this is why I wanted to make sure we remembered the two traditions. Let's look at verse 37. On the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, saying, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture said, from his innermost being will flow rivers of living water. I think that's one that would be pretty easy to miss without understanding the fact that there's that tradition of the water drawing ceremony. That for, this is the last day, the great day, so we're talking day 7. So for the last 7 days, we count that morning, people have been having a parade, marching down to this river, grabbing the water, or the pool, grabbing the water, a parade back up, dumping on the altar. So needless to say, this is at the forefront of their minds, especially when you consider it's linking to the verse from Isaiah, with joy you shall draw water out of the wells of salvation. So he's making a profound statement here in the middle of the feast. Here, I assume at the pool, from his innermost being will flow rivers of living water. It's a powerful claim. Then we've got kind of a brief interlude. You have an exchange. Everybody understood what he said. It's easy for us, I think, sometimes to gloss over, but you can see everybody understood. They're saying, oh, this is certainly the prophet. This is the anointed one. Wait, the anointed one's not going to come from Galilee. Hasn't scripture said that the Messiah comes from the descendants of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was? So there's a division. People are fighting over it. And people are getting ready to seize him. And then you've got Nicodemus. Nicodemus, the guy who several chapters earlier had came to Jesus and asked about being born again. And they had the discussion about living water. He comes to his defense and he says, whoa, our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing. Now we've got a brief interlude for the first part of John 8 about the Mount of Olives and the adulterous woman, or potentially not, there's debate. And then we come to verse 12. Now, at this point, we've got the holidays over. It may be day 8, maybe day 9, I don't know, but we're still very close in time. And it, everybody's memory, they have to remember those huge lanterns. How would you forget them? So now we've got a space, all of Jerusalem, really, but the temple in particular, which had been so bright, now it's dark. Okay? And we read in verse 12, Jesus again spoke to them, these are the people. He says, I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life. Now, it doesn't say where he said this, but does anybody want to guess? If we turn to verse 20, it actually does say. I mean, it doesn't say specifically there, sorry. In verse 20, it says, these words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one seized him because his hour had not yet come. If you know your temple geography, the treasury was another name for the woman's court. Which means when he said this, when he said, I am the light of the world, he who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. He was standing right where those lamps had been. They might have still been up. I don't know how long it took them to take them down. But there's a direct connection again. You have the lighting ceremony, the fact that these candles or these lanterns are lit, a time of rejoicing. It's very, you know, very present in everybody's mind. And then all of a sudden it's dark. And he says, I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness. Just fun tidbits, I guess. I'm going to kind of jump to the side now. As I was studying this, and I'd say, like, the first time I taught, Grant gave me, I think, like a 3 months heads up, and it was kind of just me at the time, so I spent 3 months preparing, and this was kind of like a quick Google search on the way over. Now that I have a child, it really changes things. But with Jesus' nature, he was talking to someone and he said, the foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And I think when you look at that, it really calls to mind the temporary nature of our lives, doesn't it? It brings up the fact that he didn't have a home in the sense we think of it. He didn't have something concrete. So it's safe to say that for his life, just like we're taking the next week to dwell in a temporary dwelling, that's what he was saying. He said, I don't have anywhere to lay my head. I don't have a hole. I don't have a nest. I've just got temporary dwelling. And it also reminds me a little bit of over in chapter 10 of Matthew, verse 23, where they're starting to send out the apostles, and it says, whenever they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. For truly I say to you, you will not finish the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. And that's like a little interesting thing, because it jumped out at me as I was studying the fact that we're supposed to be people of movement, people of temporary dwellings. And I guess I just never pictured, I never pictured Yeshua sitting down with his followers and being like, guys, congratulations, you're all refugees. But that's in essence what he's saying. He's saying, when you're persecuted, go to the next city. Very interesting. All right. Next little tidbit. I'm sorry that I'm shotgunning all this at you. It seems like I'm rather scattered, but hopefully something's helpful. I had mentioned a little earlier about how the holidays train us. They get us ready. And over in Galatians 3:24, you've got the verse, therefore the law has become our tutor to Christ, so that we may be justified by faith. I think it's just a simple reminder. I'm not going to dwell on that one a ton because I've got two others. But that the purpose of these holidays, the purpose of all of the law, is to point back to Messiah. It's our tutor to Christ. It draws us to him. So there's times with these commandments, you know, it's I have to build a sukkah. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Ohio's cold, but it's a tutor to Christ. As a side note, and I was going to say this earlier, but I'll just sneak it in now. If you can build a blanket fort, you can build a sukkah. It's the same skill set. You're just doing it outside. So don't be intimidated by the process. Just dive right into keeping it. Adam Groves actually has a consultation service for sukkah. Sukkah building. So if you need any help, just give him a call. I understand he does it all free and at any hour of the day. Over in Colossians 2, verses 16 and 17, it's also talking about the nature of the commandments. And this one, I like this one because people have thrown this at me when I say I keep the Shabbat. They go, whoa, what about Colossians 2, verse 16? It says, therefore, no one is to act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day, things which are a shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. And my first question is always, well, if no one is to act as my judge, does that mean no human? Does that mean not you specifically like you are right now by hitting me with this verse? Because it doesn't say God's not going to judge us for what we do. It just says no one else is supposed to judge us. But it says these are a shadow of what is to come, and the substance belongs to Christ. And just like that analogy at the beginning, I am not going to be taking my son out of his sleep sack and changing his diaper 30 years from now. I really hope. It's a shadow of what is to come. It's preparing him for adulthood. It's preparing him for independence. And that is the big part of what parents do. Like Grant said years ago, successful marriage, you keep your spouse. Successful parenting, you get rid of your kids. I wrote it down. It's probably the best thing he's ever said. But these are the commandments. They're preparing us. The commandments prepare us and equip us to better understand Messiah. So we are robbing ourselves of a tool if we choose to skip something just because it doesn't make a lot of sense. Finally, Hebrews chapter 8. It says, if Yeshua was on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. Just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect a tabernacle, see, he says, that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown to you on the mountain. But now he has attained a more excellent ministry, by as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. That was verses 4 through 6 of Hebrews 8. That's a tricky one just to dive into. If you hear that, I think this is one of those verses where when you read it, it proves whatever you believe already. It's because there's people who say, all the law's done away with. Everything's done away with. We've got just a new covenant, that's it. That's what it says. But it also says what we believe, that God's commandments are eternal. God's promises are eternal. And it's talking about there being a pattern, an improvement. Tell you what, I probably should have included that because I don't have the time to comment as much as I want to. But it's another verse that's important because we read right there, the law is a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. That's kind of the part I want to really latch onto here because the keeping of the Sukkah, just as I mentioned, was established back in Genesis. It's a pattern. It's us locking into God's calendar. God has invited us for a time to experience something. And there's a blessing in that. I've got two more sets of verses, and then we've got a little bit of practical considerations, and then we'll see where we're at time-wise. Over in Revelation chapter 21. It's just a very interesting verse. Very interesting. It's verses 3 and 4. And it says, so Revelation 21, 3 to 4. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be death. There will no longer be mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. I think that's one of those verses where the level of education and familiarity with Torah, really, that you would need to understand is kind of beyond me. But it's so interesting. It says, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people. And it creates this link that somehow in the building of our sukkah, our booths, you know, the tabernacle that we dwell in briefly, there's some kind of link between not only the keeping of the holiday and connecting with God's plan for our lives, but just the sukkah itself and Messiah. And I can't comment beyond that just because I think it'd take a long time to figure out, let alone share. So one last tidbit. Several tidbits. But when Yeshua came to the earth, you know, he had a clear mission. And I think that when I look at the sukkah is a holiday. Sukkot is a holiday of rejoicing. It's a holiday that I think follows a parallel with Yeshua's ministry. We saw earlier how... Oh, we saw how he painted these parallels between the water drawing ceremony. He painted these parallels with the illumination. He painted parallels between himself, his ministry, and Sukkot. And I look at right when he first came to the scene, he established, he made a prophetic proclamation, as it were. And I think that it is, it's him expressing to us, hey, when it comes time to rejoice, this is what you're rejoicing over. It's over in Luke chapter 4. So I think this is interesting, and I'll give you a couple seconds to turn to Luke 4 if you want to read along. Because I think as we go through the week of Sukkot, there will be times when rejoicing isn't at the forefront of our minds, but it's a commandment. And it's an interesting commandment at that, because it's not saying if you have something good to feel about, you know, feel good about it. It's saying rejoice. So we have an obligation to rejoice. That's kind of why I wanted to look at, you know, the different commandments there, because if you go through the week and you don't build a sukkah, you're not keeping, you know, the commandment. Obviously, if you don't collect your branches, if you don't give charity, if you don't have a gathering, you know, all these things, you're not celebrating Sukkot. But let's say you do all of those things and you're just a grumpy pain in the butt the entire time. You've not kept Sukkot because you're supposed to rejoice. And I think for some of us, we have a limitation of our abilities. Maybe you're stuck at home, maybe you don't have transportation, or for some reason you don't have friends and it's a lot harder to have a holy convocation. Maybe you lack a backyard or basic blanket fort skills and you can't build a structure. You know, maybe you don't have access to trees. You can't gather branches. You can at least rejoice. I think that's one of the nice things about how we do things. You keep it to the best of your ability so we can all rejoice. All right, you're all at Luke 4 by now. So it says, he came to Nazareth. I'm at verse 16, where he had been brought up. And as was his custom, he entered the synagogue on the Sabbath, and he stood up to read. And the book of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. And he opened the book, and he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach the gospel of the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives, and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord." I think that's grounds for rejoicing. Yeah, let's do that. Everybody just do an amen. There we go. I knew I could get something out of you. So we've got the commandment to rejoice. And there will be times when you're down. It's inevitable. But we can pull out Luke chapter 4, verses 16 through 21, and just skim over real quick and say, all right, I've got this good news for the poor. I've got the release of captives, recovery of sight for the blind, freedom for the oppressed, and a favorable year of the Lord. So, I've got the next stage. I figured I'd kind of go heady and shotgunny, and then I just want to go down to the practical. I collected a couple pictures of people's sukkahs. I thought it'd be good just to look at a couple and just do some basic inspiration. As an aside, as I was researching stuff, I stumbled on Deuteronomy 8:8. I guess traditional decoration of the sukkah involves, well, I'll read you 8:8. It's talking about the promised land, and it says, it's a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey. As a consequence, it's pretty traditional when people decorate their sukkahs to use wheat, barley, grapevines, fig leaves, pomegranates, olives, and I assume bumblebees. I don't know about the last one. But it's just neat to see when they decorate their sukkah, they're pulling from this imagery of the promised land. And of course, according to old rabbinic tradition, the particularly righteous may use little chili pepper light bulbs. So, this first picture here, this is Dan Remark in the setup stage of the sukkah. And as you can see, they've got the pavilion cloth type canopy things, and they've got leaves over it. So I'm just going to kind of go through them. Here it is a little more decorated. They've got all the lights going. They've got the tables set up, and you can see some candles there as well. Next shot. This one's at nighttime. I think that's a young Ben Alger, isn't that? Looking over in the lights. But you can see again, it's lit up. It's festive and enjoyable. They got the candles going. Here it is, I'm assuming afterwards. You can see the empty bottles and the scattered plates. So, next one here, this is, I found this online and I just thought it was worth sharing to validate my point about the chili peppers. I'm under the impression this is a Sephardic tradition, but you can see they've got a collection of pomegranates, the citrons, a couple of big etrogs in the middle, and then the chili peppers there. I could not afford to decorate a sukkah like that, but man, is that cool looking. So the next one, this is Grant had sent me a picture. I can't tell you who it is because it's a tad blurry, but they set up their sukkah just right there under that kind of that balcony at the back. So the bar's there. You guys can kind of work from there. Next one, I think this is an Adam Groves original from several years back. And you can see just using some tarps as an enclosure. And I think that's his feet there as he's reading to prepare for the night. I got a couple of Groves sukkahs here. Here he is with the trebs. You can see he's stepped up from tarps to some painter's blankets, and it really helps the vibe. It's nice. And then here we are in the same one. He's got a fire going. And then here's one with the caches. You can see he's brought it up against his house now, and now there's a roof, so he's gradually improving. And this one here has a small carport on the backside. It's about a mile long. So he just every year bigger and better. So this next one here, we're at the Moors. You can see they're constructing theirs. Kind of similar in construction of the Groveses because Adam Groves acted as a consultant. So they're just getting set up, and you see the kids are helping. And this is a really good opportunity, I think, if you do have children or grandchildren or just a stray child running around your neighborhood, to get people involved. Because it's relatively simple. Kids are better at forts than adults, and it brings the commandments home because it says this is what we do. And as I try to mention, you know, we're all about the establishment of a generational community. And this is one of the ways to do that, is giving kids the opportunity to share in the commandments. Because there's a lot of stuff they can't do, but this is something. So here we see Eleanor and George kind of getting the table set. And they've again got the lights going and a nice big table. Here I understand it's probably a top view taken out of a random window, but you can see, you know, kind of we got the lights going, we got the table. It's nice to be able to be hospitable. And then here we go. To justify my outfit in this picture, they were serving Mexican, and it was rather cold that day. But again, you know, it's just the sukkah in action. And then this last one, I just threw three on mine. The resolution was kind of poor, but I just threw up some 2x4s and stapled the old, it's actually an old backdrop from a theater company. So if you look, you can see on the right, that's actually the chin of a cowboy. His head's upside down. So, but it's very easy. That's as far as I have, and I am 9 minutes early according to the iPad and 11 minutes early according to the clock on the wall. So I figured we could just sit quietly and look at each other for a little bit. Questions are also welcome, or sharing. Do we have microphones, Timothy? Or you just didn't anticipate me stopping talking long enough? It's Carla back there. Thank you. Yeah, actually, let's do, in addition to questions, we've got a little bit of time. I would love to hear, for those of you that have been keeping Sukkot for a while, for those of you that have memories or stuff, feel free to jump in, too.
This is a comment. It's not a question. We spoke, a couple of us spoke with our friends in England last night, Gary and Lynn Preston. And Gary had been to what he calls Sukkot Mart a day or two earlier. And he described it as this incredibly dense gathering of all the Jews. And they show up to purchase their materials for their Sukkots.
Hmm.
And he had a gorgeous etrog, a beautiful one. It was so cool, and you know how they package them in a nice box, and it's like a gift. So I said, well, did you spend, you know, like $10,000 on that? And we were making jokes. But it's fascinating to me how the Jews lavished such attention on this fruit. Mm. This symbolic, you know, there's got to be a relationship there between this devotion to honoring this commandment and getting the perfect fruit and, you know, Yeshua. And I'm thinking about this as you're talking today, and thank you for this presentation. It's really good. But if anybody's got any insight on such a relationship, please tell me, because I'm fascinated by it. I'm sure there is one.
I have not given thought to that. Has anybody else had the opportunity to think about that? Or is that something we'll have to hit Grant with as soon as he gets back? I do know, as I'm sure everybody's familiar, Grant has talked about year after year, the etrog does represent the heart. So, I mean, there is... I'm not helpful. I'm sorry.
Hello, I'm a good friend of Grant's and Robin, and so I get to come here when I'm not with my children celebrating Shabbat. And last year we did the Sukkot. We were in tents, and so yeah, at somebody's home, and it was wonderful. But the thing is, I'm wondering, because I'm a teacher. And so I had to go to work through the day. You know, I felt, you know, that's my mission field. And that's, but how do you define, I have two questions. So how do you define laborious? How do you think the Lord, and how do you think the Lord looks? And I agree with you. Again, amen to rejoicing all the time, not just during Sukkot, but all the time, every day as he gives us breath. But, yeah, so I'm wondering about the people, like my friend here, she's a nurse. She does home care. So are there people that are so rigid that they have to dwell in these booths all day long? Or, like, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm sure there are people that are that rigid, but I don't think they'd enjoy attending Beth Tikkun. We definitely take, obviously, the approach of we are adopted into God's kingdom, and therefore there's a growth process. Mm-hmm. And the goal is never to paint a line in the sand and say, you have to be on this side or else you're going to hell for eternity. You know, it's rather we have a standard that we march towards. And every year we try to go deeper, but also that the application of our faith is something that we are held to personal accountability for. Therefore, we equip the individual to make those decisions. In Ohio in particular, I mean, we've had,
right,
you know, rainstorms, snow. But the idea, I'll say our halakha, our interpretation in general, has been eating a meal in the sukkah. You know, you build the sukkah, you eat a meal in it, you spend the time in there that you can. But the entire 7 days are not meant to be spent dwelling in the sukkah, because it's only that first day that is a Sabbath of no laborious work. So the other days you're going out into the world and then you're returning to the sukkah, but you've got that there waiting for you.
Yeah.
In terms of no laborious work, it's number one, it's best, I think, left to individual interpretation, because as we each grow and mature, we each grow in our ability to guard and keep and remember God's commandments. And also, you know, there's life circumstances. Until the end of time comes, there's going to be a lot of us that can't get off work. And I was very fortunate. I was able to get off Yom Teruah and Yom Kippur. I can't get off for Sukkot. So, I mean, I will slack as much as I can while I'm at work. But that's all I can do. In general, you know, there's people obviously understanding that there's certain things you're not going to do. You're not going to rush out and mow your lawn or build a house. But, you know, I can't change the fact that my son eats, you know, mm-hmm. So I may have to prepare him food, especially if I forgot to in advance. I mean, it's a very individual process, and I think it's best, as long as we have that attitude of we're pursuing obedience and we chase it down with God rather than kind of throwing up excuses. I think we're good.
Mm-hmm. And remembering it, like you said, from generation to generation, mm-hmm. you know, and the meaning behind it. So, yeah, that helps a lot of people to be able to, again, enjoy the Sukkot and what it represents and the fellowship. And like you said, the water and the lights, the lamps. But then if they have to go inside to sleep.
Yeah.
Because like Grant told me, you know, we don't live in Israel. You know, like you said, we're in Ohio and the weather changes. So so we experienced that last year, you know. It rained through the week of Sukkot some nights, and a couple of us fell down the hill trying to get to our tent.
What happened, yeah.
You know, we got wet. But anyway, and so what kind of work do you do?
I would be happy to chat with you about myself more later.
Okay. Okay, so you're not a construction worker.
A little bit. But Valerie has something she wanted to share real quick, and then we can be happy to touch base with you. What's my baby doing over there? Bad influences. Huh? Valerie, are you just planning on sharing about the blessing of
children? Are you talking smack to me before I give you the microphone?
The whole, I think, answer to how laborious work we do, we have to realize that this is a pilgrim feast. Mm-hmm. And in Israel, you would take that week off because you have to go up to Jerusalem. But mm-hmm. again, here in the United States, we're just obeying as well as we can. And yeah, slacking at work may help. But we have to fit these into our lives. And, you know, they said, we're Gentiles, we're to continue to be Gentiles, continue to do what we do, obey as well as we can. And I think that's the biggest answer is we have to, if we're in Jerusalem, they give us that time. Just like for Sabbath, you know, Sabbath, everything closes down in Jerusalem. But here, we gotta do the best we can.
Yeah, I think as you were talking, and we'll do Melody real quick, and then I'll share my thoughts.
Well, I wanted to piggyback off of that.
By all means.
If we remember when we went over the Didache not long ago, there was which is teachings of the apostles about Jesus, and there were things about, you know, different elementary teachings. And when it came to washings, there was, in all of them, there was grace. Like, you immerse. If you can't find a body of flowing water, use a body of still water. If you can't find that, sprinkle on the head. If you can't find that, sand. I mean, it's just like grace, grace, grace. If you can't do these things, just it's okay. But it is about finding something that hints at the spirit of it. So,
yeah.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on something concerning the commandment about Sukkot in Leviticus chapter 23. It says that the 15th day of the 7th month is the Feast of Sukkot for 7 days. The first day is the Holy Convocation. You'll do no work. 7 days offer an offering made by fire. The 8th day will be a Holy Convocation for you. You offer an offering. It's a solemn assembly. Do no work. So the first day and the 8th day are no work, Holy Convocation. But it mentions on the 8th day that it doesn't say on the first day, the 8th day is a solemn assembly. So is there a differentiation between the, you know, you rejoice for the 7 days. Is it more subdued on the 8th to acknowledge all that you've done those 7 days and like to reflect on it?
Yeah, that's actually, I probably should have touched on it. That's Shemini Atzeret, the 8th day, and it's largely considered to be a separate holiday from Sukkot. It's paired with it, it's attached to it, but it's also not it. The traditional Messianic understanding is that Sukkot is the celebration of 7 days of Yeshua coming to this world to dwell with us, and that the 8th day would have been his day of circumcision. So that's kind of where the understanding of why there's an 8th day. But the 8th day itself is both partnered intimately with and separate from Sukkot. And that the eighth day of Shemini Atzeret is a day of solemn reflection. I honestly didn't study it as much, but I mean, even when you look back at the application, I think it was in Nehemiah they mentioned. Where was it? Over in Nehemiah at the end, it says they kept the feast for 7 days, and the eighth day was a solemn assembly. We don't have as much in tradition or that's been passed down to us as in terms of understanding of what exactly that represents. So I honestly don't have the best answer. But I do think, reminds me of a point, when it comes to the keeping of the commandments, we read the Bible, obviously. And it's not always clear. So sometimes we have to hop over to the apostolic writings and look at their interpretation, how it's been, understanding has been provided to us. But sometimes that's not always enough to make it clear, too. And we rely on historical sources and rabbinic sources to flesh it out. But there's kind of this hierarchy. Obviously, if there was a rabbinic or historical source that contradicted our understanding from the apostolic writings, we would stick with the apostolic writings. But there's some things where not a lot has been passed down to us. And Shemini Atzeret is one of those. A final thought, and then I'll pray. One of the things that's always resonated with me about Beth Tikkun from the moment I came is that we are a group of people who have, in general, we've got established lives, and we're trying to figure out how to fit God's will into those lives. For a lot of people, you go years and years and years, we never celebrated Sukkot, and all of a sudden, bam, here's Sukkot, now I have to figure out how to work this into my life. But the interesting thing is there's now a second camp in Beth Tikkun. There's no longer just the people who have established lives and are trying to work the Torah into it, but there's a little camp of people who stand under that hoopah every day, or every Shabbat, who are establishing their lives alongside Torah. And for me personally, I don't know that I will ever do it perfectly. I will ever remember things perfectly. I'm never going to grasp things as deeply as I could, as if it was just natural to me. But what I do try to do is keep it well enough that it'll be natural for my son. Keep it well enough that for the next generation, they may look at us and wonder why we struggle sometimes. Wouldn't that be a blessing to have a generation of kids that wonder why we forget when Sukkot is, or why we forgot to go out and buy lumber or get branches? You can amen that if you want, but I'm going to pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you for the ability to walk with you in both profound and abstract ways and simple, concrete ways. I thank you for a holiday that I feel like I can be good at, especially after two tricky holidays. Just a simple one of gathering together in fellowship and rejoicing in your mercy and your glory. I pray that some tidbit of what I said today benefited everyone. I pray that we've all got something to take home. But more importantly, I pray that nothing I said contradicted you or your will. And if it did, that nobody noticed it and they forgot it immediately. I pray for your blessing over this day and over Oneg. Over this approaching holiday, may you help us keep it well.